Hello, welcome to another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Jeff, how are you this morning?
I'm wonderful, Sal. How are you?
I'm doing outstanding.
That's
another
awesome.
Glorious day at Premier Ag.
It is. And we've got some great guests today.
Yes, we do. We have two of them. We've got Joe Zimmerman.
How you guys doing?
He's our agronomy lead in the tracks department. And our fan favorite, who is messing around with his headset. Are you not plugged in?
No, I'm running over my cord here.
He's trapped.
I'm trying to get Hold my on. Cord out underneath my chair.
Glenn Longaball.
Well, good morning.
Before we get into introductions, and Glenn, we're going to introduce you again. We're going to let you introduce yourself again because we may have new listeners joining us. But this one is the question of the day, Joe.
Mm-hmm. What we got?
You've got a home improvement project that you are going to have to cut either power or water to your house, or both.
Or both.
Do you do it or do you call a professional?
That is, there's definitely areas of gray on that one, right? I mean, I'm pretty comfortable with most things electric. Now, if I'm going to put in like a new 240 outlet or run a whole new line, I'm probably going to call a professional. But, you know, if I'm just going to put in a new light fixture or open up some drywall, and I'm pretty comfortable, you know, cutting the breaker off there. But water scares me. I have some like outdoor plumbing, like greenhouse experience, but when it comes to the inside, I'm probably going to call a professional. I've seen too many videos of, you know, someone cutting into a wall and that water's just flowing right into the living room and they're trying to grab it. And yeah, no, not a chance on the water, I don't think.
All right. So that's when you call a professional.
Yes.
So you, all right, water.
Yep.
Glenn?
I'm probably the same. I do know that, from first-hand experience, you can't pull the meters anymore. They've improved the locks, right? You used to be just a little seal that you could clip and pull the meter and wire in your new disconnect, but that doesn't work anymore. But I'm like Joe. I feel pretty comfortable wiring about anything there at the farm. when it comes to plumbing indoors, I'm always scared of the wet drywall syndrome. So, yeah, I'm probably going to. Probably besides that, I swear, whoever designs these new plumbing fixtures, I don't care if it's a float in a toilet, right?
Yes.
Let's see how chintzy and how
cheap,
how crappy we can make it, right? And so it's a confidence thing.
Yep. Jeff?
I will actually do both.
Nice.
I will actually, you know, tackle both plumbing and electrical. I mean, there's always time to call the professionals later when you screw it up, but you know, I'll give it the old college try to start with.
You're the guy that makes it harder on the rest of us whenever there's a get together, a Premier Ag Christmas party or something. And, well, Jeff's putting in a new water heater today or something.
Or attempting.
I tell you what, I got plumbers at the house today. They're putting in some new water fixtures. Kim wanted some kind of car wash shower heads that she's putting in the shower or something like that. And
hey, and this is a PG rated.
Okay. Thanks. I'll stop right there. Yeah. But, and I'll do it if I have to, but I do not like cutting water lines in the house. I don't like doing it.
No.
Don't like putting it back together. It's sewage lines. I've had to cut those.
My problem with plumbing is I don't mind doing it. And I can go to the store, I can get all the parts, stuff that I need. And then you always have to go back to the store again because something happened where you glue that T in there and it's like, oh, it's twisted wrong. I don't have another one. So now I've got to go back. So it's always two or three trips to the hardware store and that's frustrating.
Then your time, you know, is almost worth calling that professional at that point.
I mean, now you're starting to sound like my wife, Joe.
Is that a compliment, I hope?
I don't think she meant it that way when she would tell me, why don't you just call somebody who knows what they're doing?
It's some of that stuff like kitchen sinks or something where you got to stand on your head to get underneath the cabinets and things.
Even something as simple as putting a new toilet in, you know, that wax ring, if you don't get that thing perfect, I had a buddy that didn't get it sealed properly and it just, you know, you don't see it necessarily. It's leaking, you know, underneath into your subfloor and that's
a bad day.
That's a headache. So
I replaced my last wax ring. I won't mess with them anymore. I don't care. By the time you yank that toilet off and set it in the tub,
it's not worth it.
Yep. Well, I guess we covered that topic pretty
good. We have. Yeah, we took people that were confident now and put them into a mode where they'll never touch it again.
We got some listeners here maybe second guessing what they were going to do this weekend.
Well, Glenn, tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us the introductions and how you ended up at Premier Ag. You got an interesting history. I think everybody does, but you've got your own.
Yeah, well, yeah, everybody's got history. I guess 85 graduate from Purdue University in agronomy, where I was pretty active in archery, right? I was an All-American in college and competed, you know, on a national scale, maybe not a world scale.
Well, you got close.
Yeah, in 96, for the 96 games, made it to the semifinals.
Games meaning?
Olympic Games.
Olympic Games.
Yeah.
Not the...
I've been an avid bow hunter all my life. Went to work in ag retail just right out of college and probably was over my head. But...
Had some great reps call on you, though.
Yeah, I did. I had a wonderful... let's see.
Monster.
I think all of them, except for maybe my Monsanto rep. Yeah, the rest of them were really good. So Jeff was my Touché. Monsanto rep. We're just messing. No, he was a great rep. But... I think it was 92, went to work for ICI and worked for several different companies under the, what would have been legacy Syngenta companies. Mm-hmm. And, left Syngenta on my 20th anniversary to go to work for Winfield United, worked for, Winfield for 10 years as a regional agronomist. And in most of this career with the 20 and the 10, so for 30 years, I worked primarily in Southern Illinois, but some in Southern Indiana too. So
okay.
Lots of experience. About a year ago, about a year and a half ago, retired from Winfield to be just Premier Companies agronomist.
Yep.
So did kind of downsizing because I farm with my bride and she's actually hauling grain as we speak.
Wow.
Yeah. So
I'm lucky.
I married way, way, way up.
You did.
Yeah. Or way down, you know, she, I promised I wouldn't tease her about her weight anymore. So she's out running around in the semi this morning, all 114 pounds of her. So, but yeah, she's, you know, she's actually probably the best truck driver that I've ever had because she's scared to death. Right. So if you're scared and this whole fall, all we said is no unforced errors, right? The margins are so thin that I figure as long as we don't back into a grain cart, we don't, you know, run some, you know, ingest something unnatural into the combine, don't have a wreck, don't turn something over, we'll probably survive this, you know, these poor commodity prices. But just no unforced errors is what we've – that's kind of been our slogan this fall.
Pretty good one.
Yeah.
All right. Joe?
I like that. Yeah. I've been with Premier now for 3+ years, 3.5, something like that. And prior to that, I was working at the University of Illinois. So shout out to Champaign listeners if there's anybody over that neck of the woods. I did perennial grass research there for almost 4 or 5 years, kind of mixed in some variety testing for corn and soybeans. And then prior to that, I was in a yield trial, kind of plant breeding for AgriLion Genetics, which is AgriGold would be their flagship, and did that for about 5 years as well. So got a good mix of research and scientific. I guess in college, too, I worked at a soil fertility lab, which the University of Illinois is right up there with, you know, Purdue and some of the best ones in the Midwest. So that was a really good kind of propelled me into the career that I'm in today and experience wise. But prior to that, I grew up in a small town in West Central Illinois, Avon, Illinois, not to be confused with Avon, Indiana. Two totally different
sister cities,
not even close. So if we got anybody who's listening knows where that town is without Googling it, I would be impressed. But shout out to anybody who knows Avon, Illinois. Fun fact, it was the smallest public high school in the state of Illinois at the time of my graduation.
How many did you graduate with?
26 or 27 in my graduating senior class, public. So
hard to put a football team on.
We had one actually. We co-opted with a neighboring school. So, yep. If you were involved with anything, you pretty much did it all in high school. FFA, 4-H, jazz band, three sport varsity, athlete. You kind of had to do it all. So, because there weren't enough kids otherwise. So,
the coach knew who was going to start because he had just enough starters.
That is,
don't get hurt. Kind of like you're like Glenn. No mess ups.
So that school no longer exists. It's now combined with a neighboring town, but at the time it was the smallest. I guess I've got a wife of 9 years and two children, one soon to be 5-year-old daughter and a 2-year-old son. And so they keep me very busy when Premier Ag does not keep me busy.
Fun age.
Yeah, really fun. Really fun age. So, a lot of memories being made right now. A lot of trips to ball games and the zoo and just all kinds of fun stuff going on. So,
well, speaking of keeping you busy, Jeff, this is, I think this is probably one of your busiest times. So tell us in the tracks department, tell us what you do at Premier Ag.
Yeah. So probably shouldn't even be doing this podcast right now because
you got work to do.
I'm up against it or whatever, but, no, that's fine. Probably as far as busiest weeks, this is probably one or two of the busiest stretches of to be in my position in the tracks office, especially with the conditions we have right now. Crops are coming off. I run analytics on this, and I averaged the last 3 years where we were compared to this year, and we're 25%. More sampling requests at this point.
Wow.
Than I've had any of the past 3 years, this being my fourth sampling season. So if you remember back a few weeks, we had that Hurricane Helene, I believe it was.
And
dumped 4+ inches? Exactly what we needed, right? Very slow. So after that kind of made, the fields became good to get back out on. It's just been dry and beautiful running. And so
good.
Tons of crops have been coming off, and we've just been really trying to keep up with the sampling requests, and there's been no time downtime for our sampling crews to get maintenance done because it's just go, 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 go. So it's been a challenge, but it's been really good because, I'd rather have this than the opposite where you can't get in the field at all. Right. So,
yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about a soil sampling. What's the mechanics of it? Tell us what we're doing, how do you do it? I guess the listeners that are, may not be familiar.
Yeah. So it's pretty, it seems second nature to me, but I guess, to kind of break it down, we're sampling on a 2.5-acre grids for our customers. And within that grid, we're taking 8, different cores, which make up our soil sample. And we take that at 8-inch cores is our standard. Those 8 cores go into a small bag, and it is QR coded so that it immediately ties it to that spot in the field. So it cuts out any kind of human error mix-ups in the lab. The software does not lie. The code matches that spot. And our software logs that spot, GPS. And when it goes to the lab, SureTech Labs in Indianapolis, they're testing for our different nutrients and their availability in the soil. Your 3 macros would be your nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, but of course we do not test for the nitrogen. It's such a mobile nutrient that, Glenn's talked about the nitrogen cycle and how complex it is. So really we're trying to make the best of the other 2 nutrients that are known, the phosphorus and the potassium, which directly affects how much potash and DAP you put on.
Okay.
And so you might think traditionally that farmers would go out and flat rate right across their whole field a product. Well, in some spots, you're probably not putting near enough on, where in other spots, you're probably over applying. And so we really want to come in and use the technology that we have with this grid sampling to get the right amounts in the right spots and then you know, kind of going with the other 4 hours, which are right time, right place, right product.
Right rate.
Right rate. Yep. Thank you. So
very good. So Glenn, what are we looking for in a sample? Tell us why. So now we got this sample. What are we going to do with this thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So when Joe and team, they pull these samples, they get the results back. They put them in some software, make some really nice color summaries that our growers have access to. And, you know, for me, it's not about the 4 R's. It's about the big 3 P's, right? It's about pH, phosphorus, and potassium, right? That's mm-hmm. the first 3 things that I'm going to look at, right? Is the pH in the right range? And more importantly, is it evenly distributed across the field? Because one of the real success stories of spatial technology has not been really making the applications of, you know, even the primary nutrients, the real promise or the largest success story has really been in variable rate liming, right? Mm. and you're probably saying, well, how is that possible? It's because most of the nutrients that we test in a soil sample using a Malic 3 extraction, which is an indices, right, that tells us what we think. It's not telling you what's in the soil. It's telling you what's in the soil that's potentially available to a plant, right? That's 2 totally different things. If we extracted with hydrochloric acid and just pulled all the cations out, we'd end up with these great big numbers, but those numbers are not reflective of what's really available to a plant. We use a Malic 3 extractant, which is a much softer way of pulling cations out of the soil. We get a number that we think represents how much potassium that plant really has available to it. But back to pH and variable rate technology, right? The only test that I know on a soil test that's 100% accurate is pH, right? And if we use that data to make maps that allow us to get the pH even across the field, that has a dramatic impact on productivity, right? Whether we get potassium or phosphorus or zinc, you know, whether we get these things perfectly balanced is probably not absolutely critical, right? Is it something we want to do? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But is it a have to do? No. On pH, it's a have to do. And in fact, what's interesting about like P and K is that oftentimes the places that have the highest numbers are the lowest productivity spots of the field. And the reason why they become high there is because we flat rated for years. We're not having the removal with the crop, right? Which really speaks to the fact that that a cropping is an open system, right? It's not a closed system. It's an open system. We put these inputs on and then we remove them or some portion of what's taken up in grain, right? So that's why you can't just put a biological on there and let the thing, you know, go generation after generation. It's not a closed system like a forest ecosystem or a prairie ecosystem. But yeah, the first thing I want to look at is pH. Then I want to look at phosphorus. I want to look at potassium. Hopefully when you see your report, Jeff, it's got a lot of greens and a lot of blues on there, right? If you see that, that means that you are doing a good job and you've done a good job of actually replacing what you've taken off and maybe even building to high levels, right? Or to adequate levels, right? That's what green really represents.
Kind of touching on your pH, I often tell growers that, you know, come to me with questions, that is your starting point, right? If your pH is out of whack, it does not matter how good or how well you do your other, nutrients. You got to start with having a good balanced pH.
Yeah.
And plants like a good pH between what, Glenn?
Oh, yeah. So most plants, if we're talking about grass crops, they typically want to be somewhere between 6 and it's a pretty wide range, right? Between 6 and 6.8. Very slight, what we call very slightly acidic. We're talking about legume crops. They typically like to be 6.527, right? So again, very slightly acidic. And the reason being is that, you know, when you look at macronutrients and micronutrients, micronutrients really like to be they're more available in really acidic environments, but you don't need as many of those. And the macronutrients tend to be more available in more neutral environments or basic environments. So how do you bridge that? You get just on the acidic side of neutral, which is 7, and that's where you're most available. You know, those are the big three. That's the thing I put probably the most weight on, because pH tells me what the environment is, how much hydrogen is there in the soil solution. But there is another pH that is really more important to how we manage the soil, right? And that's the buffer pH, right? So buffer pH is really another extractant, right? We used to use SMP, but because, you know, in a lab, you end up with lots and lots of, you know, the SMP solution used, when we use that, it had chromium in it, right? Well, if you do soil test after soil test after soil test, what do you do with the leftover product, right, when it contains chromium, which, oh, which is a toxic heavy metal, right?
Yeah.
And so several years ago, another system, another buffer pH called the Socorro method was determined. And what it does is it's a stronger extractant, right? Instead of just pouring water through the soil sample and measuring the pH of the solution or the hydrogen ion concentration, basically you put a slightly buffered solution through the soil, which pulls more hydrogen and really represents not the environment that the plant's growing in, but how much reserve hydrogen is over on the soil colloid. Because most of the hydrogen in the soil is not in the soil solution. It's actually stuck to, you know, it's a cation, and it actually has a really strong affinity for the soil. That's one of the reasons why it's really important to get your pH right. If you get your pH right, those sites are then bound up with things like, you know, phosphoric acid, you know, H2PO4, which is a cation, right? You think of phosphate, Jeff, as an anion, but it doesn't behave in the soil as an anion. It behaves in the soil as a weak acid because it's
phosphoric. Do you think of it in that way, Jeff?
I was thinking the exact same thing.
Absolutely. And potassium.
I mean, I was getting ready to jump in.
Yeah, potassium is a cation, right? It's held to those exchange sites. Magnesium, calcium, they're cations. Iron, zinc, manganese, those are all cations. And so we want to make room for them to be cached. And what we don't want is for those sites to be all tied up with hydrogen.
What I was actually thinking was, when you guys start talking about this whole process, what's the most screwed up soil test you've seen, Joe? And how long does it take to fix it?
Don't name names.
Good question. You know, there's always a margin of error with any thing that's human, that humans have
But I mean, physically, not the soil test, right, but the actual results.
So, I've seen pHs in the fours. I've seen phosphorus levels at almost nothing.
And so, really?
I mean, I'm talking like 8 parts per million.
Is that possible?
It can be. Yeah. It's you know, it's not an easy fix by any means. I mean,
in a field, how would we get to that point, Glenn?
Yeah, you got to that point. It probably was a
hay field.
It could have been. It could have been hay field where they were removing, you know, a lot of forage. It was probably most likely a sand field, right? Something really low CEC that didn't get spread with rock phosphate in the 40s and 50s, right?
Oh my!
If you think about it, some of our highest P levels are on the lowest CECs, and that's not. It's not really. It's not because they're doing a great job of fertilizing today. It's because they were spread with rock phosphate when it first became obvious that we were short on phosphorus.
When they dug it right out of the mine and they were came up on rail cars.
Yeah, they were using calcium fluoroapatite is the actual. Is the actual name, but it's rock phosphate. And they would grind that up, bring it up here on rail cars, and guys would shovel out of the back of a truck, right? And I remember Grandpa telling me that. Well, you go into these sand fields and they've got, you know, 60 plus parts per million phosphorus. That's not because we've been spreading a lot of phosphorus. It's a function of two things. One, there's this artifact of leftover rock phosphate. They have been fertilizing it for a crop, and yet the most limiting thing to the crop is not the phosphorus level. It's what? On sand fields. It's moisture, right? So on the years that it burns up, that phosphorus goes unused, and that's how you end up with these really high P levels. For me, if you ask, where do we see the biggest anomalies? Again, it's on the two extremes, and that's the reason why we always have cation exchange capacity, right? When you see that CEC number, that is that's proportionate to what is the relative negativity of the soil. How much clay, because that's really what holds onto the cations is the clay and the organic matter. And so it's a composite of those things, but it's a, you know, it's a measurement in milliequivalents. of the negativity of the soil, right? So how many cations can it hold on? If you have a heavier soil, you know, like a clay soil or a high organic soil has a CEC of 20, it actually has more parking spaces. It has more room to hold on to cations than does a sand that has a CEC of 5. So when we get a soil test and all of a sudden it's like, well, gee, it, you know, the pH is 5.8, and yet the buffer pH is 7.0. Well, the buffer pH would suggest, that's what we use the buffer pH for, by the way. I didn't finish that thought a while ago because I'm pretty bad about that, right? Start down this path and get to chasing rabbits and then we chase squirrels for a little while. But when you think about buffer pH and what we use that for, it's a measurement of the reserve acidity. And that's really what we make liming recommendations on. Well, you get a soil that's the soil water pH is 5.6, 5.8. That would suggest that it's a fairly acidic environment, but you get the buffer pH back and it doesn't show. Well, what that's telling you is that there's very, most of the time what you'll find is that's a really low CEC soil, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, it doesn't have the ability to hold on to a lot of cations, and there's not a lot of hydrogen in, right? Because that's what acidity is the measurement of hydrogen. There's not a lot of reserve acidity there. And so typically we make amendments, right? There's no harm or foul with over applying lime by a small measure. Now you go out there and put way too much on. Certainly you can change it. But the nature of limestone is not, I don't think that's well understood with a lot of our growers, right? When we put limestone on, they're like, oh yeah, calcium sweetens the soil. No, it's not really the calcium. It's the carbonate that sweetens the soil, that makes the soil less acidic. Because carbonate forms weak acids, it binds with the hydrogen, makes a compound called carbonic acid, which doesn't freely dissociate that hydrogen. Microbes then feed on the carbonic acid and give off CO2 and water, right? So that's the process. Calcium then is left in remainder, and it fills those cation exchange sites. So,
okay, question.
Yes, sir.
Every once in a while, we'll get a really high pH soil. Yes, sir. And it's like 7.4, 7.6, something like that.
Yes, sir.
What's the best way to get, what's the most practical way on a 50 acre field, not a spot of brambles, but on a 50 acre field, what's the best way to address that?
Yeah. So to lower pH, the school of thought historically has been to use some source of sulfur, right? Mm-hmm. Because when you use sulfur, typically the remainder, as the crop takes it up, the remainder is some, is some hydrogen in some stage. So if you use elemental sulfur, when it breaks down, it creates sulfate, right? That's the fate of most sulfur forms is sulfate. That's an oxidized form. To get that oxygen, you typically cleaved water in there somewhere, whether that was through, in this case, it would be a thiobacteria, right, that breaks elemental sulfur down and oxidizes it. Well, the remainder is there's a bunch of hydrogen given off. You know, if we're talking about landscaping plants, you could put enough elemental sulfur out there to lower your pH. Yeah. You could use enough, sulfur to probably make some radical change. But on a field scale, probably the most practical way to do it is with ammonia, right? Because for every mole of ammonia you put out, right, it's NH3, it immediately, when you put it in the soil, bonds with water and forms ammonium hydroxide. So initially, it sweetens the soil, makes the pH even higher. But those hydroxyl ions, those OH ions, literally are very soluble. They're not bound to the soil. They typically leach out. And what they leave behind is ammonium NH4, right? So for every mole you put out there of ammonia, you end up with a mole of ammonium. And the process, right, Joe mentioned mentioned the nitrogen cycle a while ago. Well, the normal fate of ammonium is to go through nitrification into what?
Nitrate.
Nitrate. That's correct. Absolutely correct.
Look at that.
Yeah. Salvatore was paying attention. Sal during class.
Sal is at the head.
I've heard this 50 times.
You are at the head.
Starting to stick.
It only took 50.
I'm not ashamed of it. I tell you.
Only took 50. Yeah. I'm going to be there for your review. This is going to be great.
Yeah.
So if the normal state of ammonium is to become nitrate, right? What happened to all that hydrogen? Well, it goes off in the soil, and that's the easiest way to lower pH is really to grow corn and put a lot of ammonia on it.
I'll be dying.
That's probably the most effective way. But it's not any harm or foul if you're very slightly basic, very slightly alkaline.
7.2.
Yeah, as long as you're in that range, you're good. Now, you get up there above that, and all of a sudden, you start seeing all kinds of micronutrient deficiencies, and you see weird stuff. Then sometimes the chemistry, depending on the chemistry, right? When I say chemistry, I'm talking about our herbicides, right? They oftentimes don't work very well in really high pHs, or the contrast, they work crazy well, right? You take like chlorimuron, something like we don't use much chlorimuron anymore, and you would see these artifacts at field entrances where they dump the limestone piles and the pH is a little higher, and you can't get anything to grow there because the chlorimuron is so persistent in those high pH environments that it lasts for years. Be careful what you ask me, Sal.
That's true. So, Joe, I guess I know you got to get back to your snake killing up there. But
yeah, there's a floater waiting in the field. He's waiting on the wreck to come from our office, and Joe's doing a podcast.
Joe's not answering his phone.
Ideally, what we do, though, we take these soil samples back. We do a variable rate application where we fix the pHs across the field. We fix the we try as best we can not to overapply, not to underapply. We use by using this data. Throughout the growing season, we'll have grower meetings this winter about in-season amendments as we chase the maximum economic yield in the fields. But then harvest comes, and we also bring in the yield data and look at removal. Correct, Joe?
Yes. Yep. It's really technology is pretty awesome these days. Most or a lot of growers now have either my John Deere or John Deere Ops and or Climate Field View. And with our software we use, Fieldalytics, is very good about having a connection with those two programs that automatically every night it syncs in new yield data as it comes off the field if we have that connection built. Which, by the way, if you are one of our growers, you can have an account to see that connection, the Fieldalytics account that is, and you're able to look at your soil tests, your recommendations, your yield all in one place. So if you don't have that, definitely give the Trax office a call and we'll hook you up. That said, when we're building these recommendations, we're looking at the soil data. And then right on top of that, we can overlay this year's yield crop, last year's yield crop. We can create averages. And so all these points in the field that we're variable rating, now instead of looking at one set of data, we're compiling two, three, sometimes four sets of data, soil type as well. And we feel very good about these recommendations we're making because the science, you know, the data tells us, you know, not only are we looking at what this year's crop took off, maybe we're averaging it with last year's crop. And then, okay, so, oh, by the way, what's the soil data like in that spot? And so when we make these recommendations, we feel very good about the amount of fertilizer that we're suggesting. You know, one conversation I had with couple of the Trax fellers up there, Evan and Blake, the other day I was talking and I said, you know, it's very easy to sit up there and be, you know, conservative with you know, these are people's livelihoods, right? So you don't want to tell them the wrong thing and you just, you know, but also you want to keep in mind that you're trying to maximize their return on investment, right? So just, you got to really consider that when you're making these recommendations. And so we feel really good that we're getting them exactly, not too much, not too little, and we're putting the exact right amount on, and that it's going to really drive those yields up for the following season.
Very good. And then you'll have time to do some planning. If grower wants to, is in the CropLink program, they can come in, schedule some time. You guys are mobile. You guys can travel to all the locations. They have kind of a Trax room set up where growers can look at their fields, look at their soil test results. They've also got access to it 24/7 on their Fieldalytics app. And we can get them taken care of.
Yeah, a couple things that I'll just touch on here. CropLink is our kind of all-encompassing program within Trax. That's the 2.5 acre grid sampling. It's the unlimited nutrient analysis and mapping. We've got the VR fertilizer. That's your potash, your DAP, or whatever else. You know, AMS, we can do that as well with. And then also the variable rate lime, which we touched on, which, oh, by the way, we feel that one application of variable rate lime more than pays for what it costs to be in the program based on the savings that you get by, you know, not over applying your lime and only putting it where it needs to be. We also do variable rate seeding in the spring. So trying to really dial in populations, planting populations based on the highest producing spots in the field and maybe some of the lower marginal ground. We want to back that off because, you know, we don't want to put more seed in there than it calls for. Another cool thing with that is we can, if you have like a lot of wooded areas, kind of talking to Glenn here, he's got a lot of woods next to his fields. And as you know, what likes to come out and munch on the edges of your fields? You wouldn't know anything about that, would you?
Yep. Critters.
And so we can really dial back those populations and reallocate that seed to the better producing spots in the field. So really we're not necessarily adding more seed that you're buying, but we're taking what you have bought and putting it in the best producing spots. So
very good.
You know, if Joe had more hair, we'd call him Goldilocks. They don't put on too much. They don't put just on too right. little. It's just right.
Yep. Well, I haven't had hair for a while. So, in addition, we also do the crop scouting and with our summer employees, we've got great interns. And then we also have the ability to come to your farm and do a quick drone scout. We fly drones around. We like to play with all the fun toys and
awesome
take pictures. One other thing I'll mention too is, we signed a contract last spring, I think it was. It's good through this fall, this whole sampling season with the Indiana State Department of Ag. And it's a soil sampling program for first-time sampling or for those who have not tested their soil in 4+ years. And that is good for up to $10 an acre. So if you're on the fence or have never soil sampled and you're considering it, there are definitely more affordable ways to kind of segue and see the value in doing this. It does cap at 400 acres per grower, but that's, you know, as far as sampling a farm, that's a good portion of, you know, your acres for most, you know, growers. And so, yeah, just something to keep in mind that we can work through that as well.
Very good.
Yeah.
Sounds like a good opportunity. You,
if I might add, it's the cheapest intelligence you'll ever gather, right?
That's a good way to look at it.
It's cheaper than yield monitors. It's cheaper than anything else. And when they do soil sampling on grids and you get these summaries back, it is totally and completely intuitive, right? Because you're going to get a colored map and red means bad, yellow means not so good, green means good. Adequate, and blue means that it's really good, right?
Yep.
I mean, that's it becomes, you know, obviously we don't have many watchers. We have mostly listeners, but I think most people really respond to visual stimulus. And when you see the map, and especially for the grower, because the, you know, for the consultant, he doesn't really know the highest the most productive parts of the field, right? It, to him, it's just another irregular shape, right? But to the grower, he knows where the good spots are and he knows where the bad spots are. And so when he sees that color map and goes, oh my gosh, right? Good it spots are the poorest. Yeah, it literally hits home.
And think about it this way. For $4 an acre, which is what our crop like, you know, cost a customer per year to use, that amount is such a small amount of funds that is driving thousands and thousands of dollars of fertilizer and telling it where to go across 4 years of recommendations. So if people ask me, well, should I sample or not? I said, you can't afford not to sample.
Yeah. I mean, you got to know where you're at.
I mean, if you're going to spend all this money, you better be putting it in the right places.
Very good. I think that's a good thing to wrap up on, unless you got something else, Jeff.
Just real quick. So Glenn just, you know, he just, you know, got done harvesting the back 80 and he wants to have soil testing done. Mm-hmm. So when he calls in and says, hey, I want this field soil tested, how long does that take for the crew goes out there, they pull the sample until he gets results back? What's the turnaround time?
Yeah, in a week when we're not just running wide open for a month now, like we are now, in a standard week. So if I hear a request on Monday, we can have a crew there either that day or the next day. It can be at the lab the next day. And then you've got about a 48-hour to 72-hour window. So I've done this several times this year already where the request comes in on Monday. By Friday, I've got the recommendation made, and they're spreading it Friday afternoon or even Saturday.
So that would be the fastest, probably.
That would be the fastest. Yeah. Yep. It's more like 7 to 10 days on average, I would say.
Sounds good.
So don't wait. When you pull out of the field with a combine,
sooner you know.
That's good counsel. Good. Yeah.
That you can turn that field in to, you know, the sooner we know, the quicker we can get results back and get it worked with.
So. Don't sit on it. If you're coming out of the comp, that's good. Thanks for bringing that up, Jeff.
Yep, that's right.
All right. Well, thank you all very much for joining us today. And Jeff, that's another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you all.
Thank you.